Yesterday, we spoke with John Ledoux of Minnesota. We highly recommend you listen at hearnow.org. He's one of dozens of thwarted school attackers. He had bombs ready to go in 2014 when he was caught. He described to us his slow decline from good student.
It kind of bothered me watching people mess around, and I wasn't enjoying things. I looked around and people were enjoying stuff, and I was just kind of living day to day, just existing. So it was more fueled by my slew of disappointment and frustration that led me to want to be violent, is because I wanted to feel satisfaction through dominance, basically.
John was later diagnosed with different syndromes. He has medication and coping skills to help him overcome his irrational lack of self-worth. He's embarrassed he even thought of hurting others. He said it may have made a difference if someone had talked to him about how twisted his thinking was. He also talked of a friend who abandoned an attack just because a student was nice to him. Our next guest says we could be learning more from these thwarted attackers. Eric Madfist is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He's also author of Risk of School Rampage, Assessing and Preventing Threats of School Violence. He joins us by Skype. Eric, you also cautioned these mass attacks, horrific as they are rare.
Yeah, that's true. So if we're talking about sort of school shootings in general, the vast majority of them actually occur in sort of urban schools and often over more sort of mundane things like over drugs or things like that or gangs. And those get very little attention, whereas these school rampage shootings where lots of people are killed get a lot more attention, but are actually much more likely to occur in suburban schools and rural schools. But again, they're still pretty rare events.
Well, as you write, any given school can expect to experience a student homicide about once every 6,000 years. So we want to stress that. But what did you find in studying and speaking to, I found it so fascinating to listen to John Ledoux, in speaking to young men in particular who had planned an attack but had been foiled, what do you start to learn about who these young people are?
I mean, the vast majority are boys. And so I do think that looking at forms of toxic masculinity, why it is boys lash out in this way. And you know, his quote right here, right? He was disappointed and frustrated, led me to want to be violent. It's because I wanted to feel satisfaction through dominance, basically. And so a lot of it is about you failed in other avenues of your life. You can't be popular. You're not necessarily financially successful, whatever it may be, that would be traditional avenues of performing your masculinity. Instead, you do the show of power. And a lot of it does have to do with boys who feel emasculated. So I do think looking at the gender dynamics and particularly having mental health counseling and these kind of approaches that look at masculinity is really important.
They might be someone who's moved from a small nurturing school to a larger school, or they might be someone who's just left school and be thrust from a school where they had issues. For instance, John Ledoux, nobody knew what was going on in his mind. And now they're thrust into like the workplace world and they can't cope.
Yeah. So, and that's also true if we talk about mass shooters more generally. They do tend to be people who have experienced lots of frustrations throughout their lives. They tend to be people who have not been successful in the way that they want to be. But in school shooters, there is a number of cases where people have been suspended or expelled or something like that beforehand, which act as sort of like a last straw before these attacks. So that's not atypical. Yeah.
Well, talk a little bit about what you've learned, and you just said people who've been suspended or expelled, and the thing that we hear all the time, that in many cases, there's been a pattern of concern about someone who becomes a school shooter. We're thinking of Sandy Hook or, you know, recently in Florida.
Yeah.
What is your observation about what's the best way to prevent this?
I think in particular, what we know is what actually averted these attacks. When I looked at these schools across the country, what it really was people coming forward when they had been exposed to some sort of threat that they had heard about, whether that's a kid. And in the majority of cases, there is some form of what the Secret Service called leakage, some form of a kid telling someone else what they're going to do, either by threatening them or trying to convince them to join up on their plot, things like that. That happens in the vast majority of cases. And it's when kids come forward to the authorities, to sometimes to parents, to teachers, to sometimes school resource officers to report this behavior, that's actually what averts these situations. And what we also know from tons of research across education and criminal justice and sociology and all these fields, that the best way to encourage reporting behavior is positive school environments. And you have a school environment that doesn't cramp down and is not excessively punitive in terms of its discipline, doesn't have zero tolerance policies. When it has an environment that people feel comfortable coming to the adults in the building, that students feel comfortable with that they can trust the people, that they're not going to get in trouble themselves, that's when they come forward. And so having a more cramped down security style environment actually makes kids less likely to come forward and makes school shootings more likely to happen.
Well, let's hear that again, because that's what jumped out at me, that you say that the more you institutionalize a school, the more you make it a police state, the less students feel that ineffable thing, that there's someone there that cares about them, that there's a teacher that will be willing to sit with them at lunch. I mean, I've been reading about teachers who are saying, the way that I try to protect students is I look for the kid who has no one to sit with them at lunch. And, you know, that kind of attitude. And, you know, some teachers might say, well, it's not my job to be a social worker. But your point seems to be the less a punitive environment, the more a comforting environment, the better chance you have of finding those people and preventing a shooting.
Yeah, some of it comes from restorative justice and applying restorative discipline principles to schools. And so that also applies even if you have, like, you know, the type of resource officers that you have and who's working in those arenas. So it's not someone who's just particularly punitive, but who has a relationship with kids, but also the atmosphere of the school broadly and that the way that they treat their kids in terms of discipline.
Well, but you just mentioned something, resources. I mean, these have to be people who know what they're doing when they're informed of a child who might have serious emotional issues. It can't just be any regular teacher. It sounds like you're saying that money and resources should go to social workers or therapists within schools. With many schools, this is commonplace, but some schools don't have on-campus therapists.
Or even smaller class sizes, sort of, there's research into sort of the ratios of guidance counselors, but also even of teachers that show that these kind of problems are lessened, or kids are more likely to come forward and deal with these kinds of issues when you have smaller class sizes. So even on that level, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because you write that post-Columbine 1999, people think that students are aware that they can't any longer have this code of silence that students have always had. And you write, no, they are not coming forward, because the environment's become so frightening and punitive. By the way, you also note two new preventive approaches to threat assessment. In other words, assessing what's going on here. One is from a professor, Dewey Cornell. It's called the Virginia Threat Assessment Guideline. Another is the Network Against School Shootings, also known as the Berlin Leaking Project, which has been, as you said, a great source in Germany about school threats. Can you just distill it down? What's new? What should people know?
In general, all of this stuff is under the sort of umbrella of violence risk assessment. The problem is there are various forms of violence risk assessment that are based on aggregate data and sometimes sort of stereotypes that are problematic. So the idea that there's a profile of school shooters and we have to follow people who dress differently or wear trench coats or stuff like that, or like, you know, different kinds of music, that's problematic and not really empirically based. In contrast, we can talk about threat assessment, which is sort of a more specific thing where you're actually looking at the substance of the threat itself, how detailed the threat was, how actionable, how doable the threat was. If you threaten to blow up the moon, that's not a sort of realistic threat, right? But if you've actually taken actions to engage in that threat, so if you've actually collected weapons, you've sort of written extensively about your plans to do it, those are the kind of threats that you take more seriously than someone just sort of randomly offhandedly saying you want to kill someone, or a threat that doesn't have the same kind of detail or realistic sort of actions taken behind it. So looking at the substance of the threat to sort of assess how serious it is.
But by the way, we're hearing about the Florida shooter. People are so bewildered because they've been saying that, you know, the family that he lived with, for instance, he seemed so happy recently. He seemed the best he ever was. Is it somewhat like suicide? We hear that when people finally make up their mind to do something, they actually are lightened. I mean, the fact that somebody is suddenly in a, you know, one of the best moods they've been in, doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to do something. It may mean that they are, and they're relieved they don't have to worry about it anymore.
Sure. No, I think that makes some sense. I mean, certainly a lot of school shooters and mass shooters are also suicidal. They often will kill themselves at the end of the act or commit suicide by cop. So I think there are definitely some similarities there.
Eric Matfis, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Washington, Tacoma, also the author of Risk of School Rampage, Assessing and Preventing Threats of School Violence. And again, he rushes to say they are so rare, but so frightening when they do happen. Eric, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.